Hello, and welcome to the Clinical Care Options Infectious Disease Podcast. I'm your host, Jessica Adams. This episode is taken from a webinar on cutting-edge concepts in HIV care, featuring Dr. Paul Sachs. Dr. Sachs is the clinical director of the HIV Program and Division of Infectious Diseases at the Brigham and Women's Hospital and a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School in Boston. In this episode, he will discuss long-acting therapies for HIV treatment. For the full online educational program, please visit the link in the show notes for this episode. Now let's get started and hear what Dr. Sachs has to say about what's new in long-acting therapies for HIV treatment.
So let's start with the treatment, long-acting therapies. So here's a case. It's this 37-year-old woman who's been doing great on her one pill a day treatment, but she's kind of interested in going on something different. And she maybe got some direct patient advertising on Cabotegravir or rilpivirine and injectable. She doesn't like to take pills in front of her friends or from her family. And so she wants to know about getting long-acting Cabotegravir or rilpivirine. So let's talk about this. This is the only approved treatment for HIV that is given as injections, as the complete regimen. All the other treatments are oral as complete regimens. And so this is standing alone right now. And first it was approved for two injections every month. And now it's two injections every 2 months, which I can tell you based on my very skillful math is half as often as previously. And people really prefer coming in 6 times a year rather than 12 times a year because there are challenges. First is that these are medications administered in the clinic. And in the clinic means a healthcare provider has to do it. This morning, I actually did it myself, along with one of our nurses who does it most of the time. And so I am also going to talk about these injections in some more detail. Some people have raised concern that elevated body mass index might lead to difference in absorption and drug levels, because if you're really giant, maybe you need a different distribution of these medicines. And then there's the whole logistics and operational rollout and uptake and scheduling and all those things. This is a harder treatment to give than writing a prescription for someone and just telling them to go to the pharmacy. However, there are people who really, really want this. So let's talk now about the optimal candidates, people who are suppressed on their oral regimen for at least 6 months, I'd say. It says 3 to 6 months, I'd say 6 months. These medicines are renally, they're hepatically cleared, so it doesn't matter what renal function a patient has. People need to be engaged in healthcare, and they need to understand that in order to get this successfully, they have to come in 6 times a year at least. Now, one thing we will say is that there are some contraindications. And if you are seeing a patient with a history of resistance, you want to make sure it's not resistance to the drugs that they're taking. And the example in the question we gave you was K103N. K103N is a resistance mutation associated with the drug efavirenz. And so this is not efavirenz, this is rilpivirine. And so rilpivirine is still active against K103N. Prior virologic failure, that indicates they're probably not so adherent to treatment. And then very important. So I'm going to stick with this last bullet on this contraindications slide, chronic hepatitis B infection. Now, why might that be? And that's because everyone with HIV and chronic hepatitis B needs to be on a tenofovir-containing antiretroviral regimen. And of course, tenofovir antivirals are the oral antivirals. Tenofovir is very commonly used as part of oral HIV treatment, and there is no hepatitis B treatment in injectable cabotegravir rilpivirine. So an absolute contraindication to injectable therapy as of right now is chronic hepatitis B infection. Okay, you got that? I don't think I need to say it again, but you're going to remember chronic hep B as a contraindication to long-acting injectable. So let's look at some of the data that inform this. This is data on ATLAS-2M. And let me show you the study design. This took people who were virologically suppressed. Some of them were already in a different study called ATLAS. And some of them were just receiving standard of care, that's SOC, antiretroviral therapy. And then they're randomized to receive first an oral lead-in of the drugs to make sure they tolerate it well. And then the randomization subsequently is to every 8 weeks of cabotegravir or piperine, or every 4 weeks of cabotegravir or piperine. And we now have a couple of years of data on this. And just to cut to the chase, I'll tell you that every 8 weeks looks pretty good compared to every 4 weeks, and the patient satisfaction was much higher. And this is looking at virologic success with 4 weeks versus 8 weeks, very well tolerated. I will show you something of some slight concern. I mentioned the patient satisfaction is higher for every 8 weeks rather than every four. This is, as I said, half as many visits, but there is this numeric imbalance of confirmed virologic failures and development of resistance. So at least numerically, a person on every 8 weeks treatment has a higher risk of treatment failure and resistance than every 4 weeks. It's of some concern, but look at overall, the percentages are very low. Only 2% of the study participants developed confirmed virologic failure. So it's a absolute risk is somewhat higher for every 8 weeks, but the relative risk is somewhat higher for every 8 weeks, but the absolute risk is still quite low. So that's the ATLAS 2M, and 2M is what stands for 2 months. So what might be some of the predictors of virologic failure with injectable cabotegravir or piperine? And this is a retrospective analysis looking at the people who did fail. And one of the most important things by far, actually, I'm going to say the most important thing is the first thing on this table. We have to make sure that our patients do not have resistance to rilpivirine, because rilpivirine resistance-associated substitutions at baseline had an odds ratio of failure of 40.36. That's a high one. So we really have to make sure that they have not had treatment failure on rilpivirine or have resistance to rilpivirine. Now, cabotegravir resistance is also a no-no, but that's much, much less common. Rilpivirine has been around for a while. It has a lower resistance barrier. So really, you'll want to avoid having any rilpivirine resistance before you offer this treatment to any of your patients. So it does say that if only have, these are the other risk factors, low trough concentrations. We don't measure concentration, so this is not going to be known. Baseline subtype A6 or A1, how often do you know the HIV subtype? Rarely. And then large BMI is a risk factor, but alone it really does not predict anything. So that means when you look at the package insert for cabotegravir or piperine, they highlight that patients who receive this should have no history of treatment failure and no known or suspected resistance to either cabotegravir or piperine. And that's very, very appropriate given what we've learned about this therapy. So there is a further look at this by a body mass index, because it's so common for people to be overweight. And you can see that along with, looking at the data from these studies, the people who had a high body mass index didn't have higher rates of, higher rates of virological failure. One thing that is recommended, though, is if people have a very high body mass index, that we use a 2-inch needle rather than the 1.5-inch needle. So that is something that can be done relatively easy during the injections. So that looks at body mass index, and let's talk about now some practical considerations for long-acting cabotegravir or piperine. As I mentioned, this is not self-administered, at least not yet. There is an optional oral lead-in. I, for one, have stopped doing this in our patients who are starting this. They can just go right to the injections. One does start off with an every monthly injection, and then you shift to the every 2 months. If you use a needle that's below 23 gauge, you get into some trouble, because when you look at this medicine, it's got some sort of particulate granular matter that can sort of clog the needle, but a 23 gauge needle is completely fine. And then the ventrogluteal location is the preferred spot for these injections. It's not a typical intragluteal benzathine penicillin shot. It's in a slightly different location. And generally, I follow the nurse's advice, and we give one of them on one side and the other on the other side. And I always give the rilpivirine on the right and cabotegravir on the left, because rilpivirine begins with R. Wasn't that clever of me? So there are now studies in the, quote, real world, where you see how you can do this. And this is one of those. It's a phase 3B implementation study. And patients were enrolled, and they basically got the, all of them got the injections who wanted it. And the take-home lessons were that the key strategies for clinic implementation were good communication, teamwork, and use of some sort of online planner. Surprise, surprise. Patient adherence, you know, you want people to come in within a 7 days of the scheduled injections, and give them a set appointment before they leave. And then, of course, utilize your clinic to get people to schedule for you. And you can see that this is not like coming in for your flu shot, but over time, people get more efficient. In this customized study at month one, the median visit time was 57 minutes, but as people got more familiar with this, then it went down to 34 minutes. Some other things to do are to check a viral load, especially after unplanned or missed visits. Definitely to check for resistance. If there's confirmed viremia, that would be a viral load greater than 200. If people can tell you ahead of time, I'm not going to be around to get my injection, then bridge them with oral therapy. You can just basically switch them right over. And then there's, in the package insert and prescribing information, there's specific advice about how to give this if people miss injections, and that's summarized on this slide. And then transitioning to oral therapy is very easy. You can basically do it anytime within 4 weeks of the last IM doses. So I am just reading here what is on this slide. This is very good information from the package insert. And then they also describe information about the delayed and missing doses. So I mentioned this oral therapy issue and direct to oral therapy. It's called direct to intramuscular therapy. There was some concern when this was being developed that you had to do this oral lead-in because, you know, as one of the pharmacists told me, if you inject a long-acting treatment and the person has a side effect, you're not getting it back. You know, it's basically you can't take it out of someone. And by the way, these drug levels can be detected for months after they get the injection. In general, though, these are such well-tolerated medicines with such a low incidence of immediate hypersensitivity or other life-threatening hypersensitivity that one can go to this direct-to-inject strategy. And earlier this year, the FDA said, yes, that's fine. And I have to say, with very few exceptions, that is exactly what we're doing. We're giving people this medicine. Just inject them. If they're virologically suppressed on oral therapy, if they want to make the trade-off to injectable, we do it the same day that we have access to the medicines. So who's the right person for someone to get this? As I mentioned, everybody has to be virologically suppressed. And, you know, this is a slide that Darcy Wooten from UCSD put together. She has, at UCSD, they have a very large program called SHOT Clinics. And their pharmacists are really engaged in it. And they always have a supply of the medication around just to make sure that if there's an unexpected visitor or someone comes in who says, look, I'm going to be away next week. I came in a little early, that they can give it. There are some other strategies that are being used in people who have barriers to good adherence. And there's one study called Latitude, which is looking at giving people payment to get them virologically suppressed. And then I know that there are several places that have used mobile vans. So I have to say, there is this other population. Like when people hear long-acting injectable, I think sometimes the first thing they think about was, wouldn't this be best for people who cannot take oral medicines or won't take oral medicines or start and stop and start and stop? And it wasn't tested in that population. But the folks at UCSF up in San Francisco have a very difficult to treat patient population in their safety net clinic called Ward 86. And so 132 patients were referred, 39 then got two follow-up injections. 24 of the 39 were already suppressed and they maintained suppression. But probably most interestingly, and something for the future, is that 15 of the people were not virally suppressed So they weren't taking oral ART, and they ended up actually doing really well. So that small pilot trial study may lead to a change in how we use this regimen. So there are some other long-acting injectables in the works, and the one that is furthest along is lenacapavir. And you can impress your friends in infectious disease if you remember this drug lenacapavir, because it's the next one coming. And there have been two studies looking at lenacapavir. One is in very heavily treatment-experienced patients, and it actually showed that it really did add to their ability to get virologically suppressed, because 83% achieved suppression, and especially high rates if they had active drugs in their OBR, which stands for optimized background regimen. And then there's another study of lenacapavir given to people who are just starting therapy, and you could see they had high rates of virologic suppression. And why am I focusing on lenacapavir? Well, one, because I said it's going to be the next one to be given, but two, it's actually every 6 months. Now, partnering lenacapavir with something else is not going to be possible right now that's given at the exact same time, because every 6 months is common enough, but it can be partnered with other long-acting drugs, and I hope that we see some studies using lenacapavir with other long-acting drugs. So resistance can develop to lenacapavir. I just think it's important to know the resistance profile of all the new medicines. It appeared in both of these studies, in CAPELLA and CALIBRATE, that resistance to lenacapavir was more likely if either A, patients had no adherence to the other treatment. So if you're giving them an injection every 6 months with lenacapavir, and in the background, they're supposed to be taking other oral antiretroviral agents, but don't, that would be a risk factor, because then they're really on lenacapavir monotherapy. And the other risk factor is in the bottom of the left-hand table, you can see no fully active antivirals in the optimized background regimen. If there's basically nothing else that works at all, lenacapavir is unlikely to work on its own. And that's just part of sort of standard HIV care, that we don't have any drugs that work totally on their own, just one drug. So because these injections are every 6 months, it's important to know how often people have ISRs, or injection site reactions. And you'll note that actually a high proportion of people do report something. So you can see it's about, the first dose, about 25%, and in the CALIBRATE study, a little lower. But I just want to emphasize something, is that the vast majority of these are grade one, meaning very, very few. And most of the patients did not lead to study drug discontinuation. A few of these nodules that develop after lenacapavir administration have been biopsied, and they look like a foreign body reaction. And it's not related to the formulation problems that lenacapavir had, where there was some glass particles that were released into the medications, but that's actually been solved. So to wrap up this section on treatment, it's now approved for monthly and every 2 month treatment, the long-acting CAB and rilpivirine. You do get virologic failure in a small number of patients, and it seems numerically more common on every 8 week compared to every 4. I would feel comfortable, and do feel comfortable, giving people injectable therapy without having them have the oral lead-in, which is sort of annoying. And then there are other drugs in the works for long-acting injectable, in particular, lenacapavir.
Thank you very much to Dr. Sachs, and thank you to our listeners for joining in. As a reminder, to view the full Contemporary HIV Treatment and Prevention 2022 program on the Clinical Care Options website, and to access the slide set for cutting-edge concepts in HIV care, click on the links in the show notes for this episode. Please be sure to check back regularly for more episodes on important infectious disease topics. Thank you, and have a great day.